Morning, Niners and Travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we're going to take you on a little quick tour of Nashville and beyond, or at least of the Nashville Music City Food and Wine Festival, which we just got back from.
We sure did, and we got to talk to a lot of people, and we're going to bring you as many as we can in today's program. And organizing it was quite a challenge. We were going to start off with three of the top chefs in the Music City itself, and then we're going to go on to a very intriguing new hotel property with a fine restaurant as well, also in Nashville, and then a round robin of great chefs from across the country who graced the city
and gave us good food.
That too. So that's kind of today's program, and then we have a little surprise for you all at the end. First up in alphabetical order, Christopher Anderson, newly named and appointed chef of a restaurant that doesn't even have a name yet.
Christopher Anderson, you were advised not to say. So you're a restaurant which is a big news item in Nashville, Tennessee. You're sure you can't tell us what the name is? No, I can't tempt you to do that. But listen, this is breaking news. A new restaurant opening in an old hotel, a traditional hotel, called the Hotel...
The Hutton Hotel.
And tell us about what this means to you as a project you're right in the middle of right now.
It means a great deal. It's one of the first things that I've been able to kind of step away from Chicago and be able to come back home and do something that's a little bit more me and kind of design it from ground up. I got the chance to design the kitchen and partner up with Electrolux and kind of get their made-to-measure series. It's getting custom built right now in Switzerland and shipped over. So it's kind of a whole new experience, a whole new Hutton and a whole new me.
We were lucky enough to find out about you from people who are sort of publicizing your opening, but it's not real until about when?
Till about November 15th is the tentative date right now.
And you have quite a background in the culinary arts. A couple of names you mentioned in your career that have helped you to get where you are.
Yeah, absolutely. I kind of started my venture, left from North Carolina from culinary school, and went out to Lyon, France, and worked for Auberge de Lille at a 2-Michelin star. Came to Chicago, worked for Grant at a 3-Michelin star, L2O for another 2-Michelin star, and then finally at Moto, where I kind of found my home, which was 1-Michelin star. And then when I took over for executive chef, I ended up earning my own Michelin star there, actually, in 2016.
At Moto.
At Moto, yes, ma'am.
That was pretty exciting, huh?
I thought so. It's kind of nice to be able to see your name in the Michelin Guide book. To us, it's kind of like winning an Academy Award. So it's kind of the creme de la creme.
Now, what style of cooking will be at this new restaurant that doesn't have a name?
Best way to describe it is going to be kind of two different styles. So we're going to have an upscale casual concept, and we'll also have a fine dining concept. So first, we're really going to promote and put in work for the upscale casual concept. I mean, we're going to be doing the fine dining dinners about once a month, and as long as everything goes according to plan and it goes really well, we'll also be opening a second restaurant within a year or two attached to that. A little 20-seat ultra fine dining along with the upscale casual concept that we're doing right now, which will be a southern version of our food, just done with a lot of finesse and done with techniques that I've kind of learned from all over.
I was going to ask you, with the background included, Lenny and Moto, I mean, are you a modernist cook?
Yes, I am a modernist cook. It's to me, I don't want to alter the flavors or change our culture any. I just kind of want to bring different techniques and kind of alter textures, alter the look of it, artistic plating-wise style. Because to me, you kind of need to know how to cook before you can start pumping in all the chemicals. Chemicals really just change, you know, texture, consistency, and appearance. It's not going to teach you how to cook. So, and you kind of need to know how to use it. And we've been using modernist techniques and food on the shelves for years. It's just now getting into restaurants to where we're able to use it to manipulate the way it looks and tastes.
I just got an invitation to get a review copy of modernist bread. It's like, I can't remember how many volumes, and even they have a cheat sheet I can use before the interview of McGoya, the person doing the interviews. It's 1,000 pages or something.
Modernist cuisine?
No,
The Five Modernist Bread? Okay, I have not seen that. I know Modernist Cuisine has like five volumes and thousands of pages, but yeah.
This is all about bread.
Bread. I didn't dabble as much into that. I've done bread. I did bread in France for a little bit when I had to go work in pastries for a month. Chef de Cuisine kind of wanted to get me well-rounded. But other than that, I kind of did a lot of focus on the savory section. I can kind of dabble in a little bit of everything so far as pastries and bread, but that one I'll have to check out.
Mirvold co-authors with Francesco Mingoia. And then that's coming out. It's maybe out now. I don't know.
So let's do it by the numbers again. The location is 1880 on what street?
It's 1808 on West End Avenue in Nashville.
And is there going to be a web? Oh, I can't ask you what the website is for the new restaurant, can I? Because we don't know what the name is yet. But if people want to find out more, where can they go?
I'd go to thehutton.com to be able to see the Hutton Hotel, and then that'll have all information that's pertaining to that. And just in case anything crazy happens, if they knock down a wall and discover 10 more problems. But hopefully not, and hopefully we can open on time on November.
Well, we're hoping to be among your first customers, Chris. We'll let you go back to work because we stole you away from cooking something really fine. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Absolutely. Thank you as well. Hope to see you in November.
Next up, Brandon Chavans. Yes, the last name is French, not Tennessee, but Brandon is the chef at Moto, one of a group of restaurants. They like ownership in groups in Nashville, right, sweetheart?
Yes, indeed.
Lots of places. And apparently all the restaurants in this group are all pretty much next to one another in a place, section of Nashville called the Gulch.
Gulch. That's the
Okay, Brandon Chavan, with a French name, from Atlanta, now working in Nashville, Tennessee. How come lamb ribs from Colorado?
Well, we were fortunate enough to be paired up with Nyman Ranch, and it was a product that not a lot of people have been able to use, and we were really excited about them because they're, you know, exceedingly delicious, and we thought that we could do them justice in an event like this.
Now, when you're saying a lot of people don't use it, the cut, I guess, is for those who like their lamb really lamby and a little bit hard to chew.
I mean, that can certainly be the case. I think it's more a situation where a lot of folks maybe just aren't exposed to them as they might be, you know, a typical lamb chop or a leg of lamb. And so not knowing how to cook it can be tricky. So we wanted to bring it to the event and make sure that people saw another side of the animal.
And okay, and we mustn't forget, although we'll come back to talk some more about the lamb, that on a day-to-day basis you're cooking things that are perhaps a little more straightforward than lamb ribs and part of a restaurant group scattered over Nashville. Tell us more about them.
So I work for a group called M Street. We're pretty centrally located in the Gulch neighborhood of Nashville. And we have six different concepts that all have different sort of areas of focus. Moto specifically is geared towards contemporary Italian cuisine. And it's true, we do have a lot of more approachable items for every type of diner. We also have some things that are maybe a little more esoteric and have a bit of chefy allure to them, if you would. But M Street's a pretty phenomenal group, and all of our concepts are right next to each other. So it's a great opportunity for people to sort of hop around and experience six very different types of cuisine all in one go.
Now, what did you do before that?
Before this, I was working in restaurants in Atlanta for a company called Ford Fry Restaurants, most recently at a restaurant named Marcel.
Okay, now give us some highlights of what's on the Moto menu. If people are pondering the idea of coming to visit, first of all, let's make sure we record your website into here. But tell us some more about what you think are a couple of delicious dishes that you enjoy, that your patrons also enjoy.
All right, so my personal favorite right now is secreto of pork. It's, you know, again, one of those odd bits that's from behind the shoulder of the animal. One of our crowd favorites is certainly our black bucatini, which is a seafood pasta that's based around lobster and shrimp and octopus It's got a little bit of sherry and a little bit of spice. It's very, very nice. And then probably the staff favorite would be our Campanelli. That's sausage ragu with peas.
Oh, sounds so delicious, won't it?
In Italian, mette moto means to start the car. So why are you called moto?
So Moto is fortunate to have a very beautiful space. It's wide open, principally because it's an old manufacturing facility. And the name Moto means in motion, or mezze moto, to start the car, to begin motion. And that's principally because the feeling of Moto should be one that's very vivacious and very sort of hip, I guess would be the word.
Hip before we use the word hip. There was a time before that, sweetheart. You remember that?
Name
time before hip.
Well, no. Cool. No. Brilliant. No.
It would have been brilliant in England. To some teenagers, it would have been rad. What's the word you would use?
I would just say that it's on the pulse.
On the pulse. There's a poet inside you, Brandon. Thank you so much for talking to us.
And closing out the Nashville entrance in today's program, Tandy Wilson, and you'll hear about Anne and Tandy in the interview.
Anne lusts after some chef's cooking. I'm never entirely sure why, except that she has an absolutely wonderful palate for food. So somehow she attached herself to Tandy Wilson and said, anytime we're in Nashville, we have to go to his restaurant. I said, okay, tonight we're not going to be able to do that. Tandy, why is that?
Because I'm here at the festival with y'all.
And the festival, let's explain what it is.
We're here at Music City Food and Wine together right here in downtown Nashville.
And it's a major event called Harvest Night.
That's right. Yeah, Harvest Night. It's a big fun time. The music's about to kick up and get real good.
Yeah, we better finish this interview before that happens.
Yeah, the Family Stone's loud.
But seriously, City House Restaurant, founded how many years ago?
We turned 10 in December.
Oh, great. Oh, that opens up all kinds of new possibilities for James Beard Foundation Awards. You got one already that was pretty special, right?
I'm good where I'm at, but it opens up the ultimate award, in my opinion. Yes.
Now let's remind our listeners what that was.
The best restaurant. I mean, if you win best restaurant, to me, that's the end-all, be-all.
But your award, you already won.
I won Best Chef Southeast.
Okay.
Yes.
Did you cry like Mike Lotta did?
Yeah. Oh, hell yeah. How do you not cry? I tell you, I don't know how I didn't cry on stage, but I didn't. And I made it through, but then I just fell apart right afterwards, you know, by myself with a bunch of strangers bawling.
Yeah, well, we have pictures of your good friend Mike accepting a long overdue award.
That's right.
For his restaurant in Charleston, South Carolina.
That's right. That's right.
There was something else I was going to say, and I can't remember what it was.
Well, no, I mean, I think it's been the end of a really long night, and you're tired, and the music's going to start up soon, and we won't be able to hear anything else you say. So if you have anything else you want to say, you better say it now. But I will say also, I also love you, Tim.
I just want to say it's a pleasure seeing y'all. I love you here year after year, and it's great to talk to you.
And we'll be back with a fascinating story of a new but old hotel in Nashville right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Sarah Robbins, you are the Chief Hospitality Officer of this, what do we call this company? 21C? We don't say Century. 21C Museum Hotels. And you just opened this one where we are now in Nashville. give us a little background of the company, where it originated, how many of these you have.
So it's a pleasure to be with you. And yes, it's 21C Museum Hotels. We opened our first property in Louisville, Kentucky in 2006. And it was an old warehouse building. There were five buildings that were all joined together and then renovated and created a hotel and a museum and a restaurant. And that became the model for all future 21Cs. The museum piece and the art, contemporary art, is really what guides us. It's our reason to be. And it impacts the guest experience, it impacts our team experience, and it really works like an independent museum, rotating exhibitions frequently.
I'm not sure. Why did you, a hotelier, I'm assuming there is a singular person involved, go in this direction?
Our founders are Laura Lee Brown and Steve Wilson. They are contemporary art collectors, a married couple that lives in Louisville. And about 11 years ago, or a little bit before then, they really wanted to bring life back to their hometown of Louisville, Kentucky, and thought they would love to do a contemporary art museum. And friends convinced them that they probably needed something to help produce revenue and support and sustain that museum piece, and that was where the hotel and the restaurant were added to it. So it really comes out of their love and passion collectively of collecting contemporary art.
And you said this is not really your background, so you don't want to talk about that, but I mean, it actually is my background, and I want to say that it's like cutting edge stuff on a lot of videos in this particular exhibition, and the exhibitions change, so there's always something new. And you say people can walk in off the street to see this stuff.
It's probably my favorite part about the property is that there is free museum to every city that we go into. That is what we're also bringing to that property. So then in a lot of hotels, if you're a local, you don't necessarily have a reason to visit. But for here and for our properties, it is free, open to the public 24/7. And we really do mean 24/7. And it's delightful when people are wandering around the galleries at 3 o'clock in the morning and taking a moment to have a little time in that sacred space. And the exhibitions do rotate. And so Steve and Laura Lee are still actively collecting, and they purchase. We borrow a tremendous number of artworks, and we also lend a lot of the artwork in the collection. So,
do you have on staff or curator?
We have an enormous museum team that they truly function like another museum institution. So Alice Grace Stites is the chief curator, and she designs all of the different exhibitions that rotate from property to property. And she has a staff of about 15 people that help. It's complicated efforts, but they help hang, store. They ship it. And again, we have an underground storage in Louisville, Kentucky, where all of the artwork is stored. And it really does mirror all of their standards, all of their procedures mirror what a true museum does, which is why people are willing to lend to us and why we are also able to lend out to people, because it is run like a really well-done museum.
I mean, I think the concept is really off the wall, but I love it. You're mainly in the South so far?
Yes, it's primarily in the Southeast right now, as far west as Oklahoma City and as far east as Durham, North Carolina. But the properties are Louisville, Kentucky, Cincinnati, Ohio, Bentonville, Arkansas, Durham, North Carolina, Lexington, Kentucky, Oklahoma City, and now our seventh in Nashville. And we are under construction in Kansas City and have announced a project in Miami in the Design District.
Oh, so that's moving into a top echelon of cities then. It's not all smaller places.
Correct. I think it's happened kind of organically and rather naturally that we've ended up in the cities that we have. In a number of our cities, we have local partners that have asked us to bring our 21C Museum Hotel to their hometown, and we're delighted to do that. So some of them have happened because of that specifically, that it wasn't necessarily that we sought out to go there, but it was in response to a request, and then we ended up falling in love with their cities or falling in love with a particular building they have. So it's all happened, I guess, organically, as they say.
Well, put Pittsburgh on your list. One of the big hits in Pittsburgh is the Ace Hotel, which was really a surprise that Pittsburgh was that would attract an ace, and it's done very well. What are some of the other, I don't want to say idiosyncrasies, what are some of the other aspects that differentiate this as a hotel from other hotel chains?
Well, it makes me think of my favorite subject, which is food. So we do run our restaurants with a more independent restaurant tour approach. That was my background. That's what I specifically oversee for 21C is the food and beverage role. And I wouldn't really know how to run a hotel, a true hotel dining room, because I have never done that before. So my approach is always what I enjoy, which is other independent restaurants in lots and lots of different markets. So we really try to react and respond not only to the local community that we're going into, but also really in a lot of these historic rehabilitations, we really try to respond and react to the building itself to determine who and what the restaurant is going to be, and then bring in a chef and appreciate that perspective and try to really find the right people, appreciate their creative process, and then my job is really to get out of the way.
And we did interview your chef here. Tell us about the restaurant in this particular hotel.
So I was delighted. LaVon Wallace worked with us in Louisville at our flagship property there at Proof on Main, and then left to come to Nashville, where his wife was from, and had an opportunity to work with Donald Link and open Cochon Butcher. Yeah, it's a really excellent restaurateur. So when someone calls, you know, when Donald Link calls you, you go. And so he went, and I was thrilled for him. Just it was neat to see him have that opportunity. And so he did that project for a little over a year. And then when 21C was, Nashville was going to be opening, he wanted to rejoin the family, and we welcomed him back with open arms. And he helped then create and develop the concept of Gray and Dudley, which is our restaurant here in Nashville. And I think his approach changed, which was exciting to see, that development of the creative process for a chef, to see that evolve over time. As a person on the sidelines watching that, it's pretty exciting to see how that works. So his style in Louisville felt like it was right for Louisville. And then his approach in Nashville, I think he's simplified things that he used to, you know, if there were five ingredients that he would put on the plate in Louisville, he would get excited and maybe put on two more. Whereas here in Nashville, I think if there were five ingredients on a plate, then he would say, gosh, I wonder if I could do it in three. And so that simplification, really letting the products stand, having them really approachable and just feel truly like a warm hug, not to be cheesy, but that's how most of the food feels to me, it's incredibly comforting, but yet clean, and you can really eat through a lot of dishes on the menu, which is what I like to do.
Well, hopefully we'll have a chance to try that out. Rabbit had a question.
I just had an observation. Just over to my right here, about 8 feet away, is a blue penguin that is... taller than our grandson, and he would be wild with excitement if he saw one. This is a blue one. I understand some of the properties have red ones. And looking out over the other side, there's a little sign that says penguins napping. I didn't realize that plastic penguins needed naps.
Don't we all need naps? So the penguins napping was to give someone privacy, because we're using this event for the public this weekend. But the penguins come from the Cracking Art Group, which is an artist collective out of Italy. And our owners, as I mentioned, Laura Lee Brown and Steve Wilson, originally saw an exhibition of the red penguins at the Venice Biennale, I believe back in 2005, and fell in love with them. They were scattered all over the city, and so they purchased some as part of the opening exhibition in Louisville, and then they really took off from there. People seemed to really respond to them. They reacted to them. There is some element, I feel like, the way that their posture and how they stand seems very at your service. So it seemed to somehow also fit into the hospitality business that we're in. So we do have a different colored penguin for every property. So when we go to a new city, often that becomes the topic of question of what is the color of the penguin. And we've approached that differently for each project.
Okay, so when you come to Pittsburgh from Nashville, remember who won the Stanley Cup, and the colors you should use for your Penguins are black and gold. And I think that's an appropriate point to wish to close out this interview. Thank you. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Okay, now we get to the really hard part. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 nationally prominent chefs, one after the other. Trying to get their attention was hard. Trying to hear their voice over the din was hard. But the food was wonderful, right, sweetheart?
Yes, indeed it was.
Okay, so we're going in alphabetical order from Atchison to Shire, and we'll introduce each one very quickly as we go along. Hugh Atchison from Athens and Atlanta, Georgia. And his first famous restaurant was 5 and 10.
Okay. Hugh Atchison, I mean, we've interviewed you before. You were everywhere anyhow. And you're an iconic Southern chef. What are you serving tonight?
I'm doing a chicken consomme with autumn vegetables and apple.
I really want to know what you're up to, because you keep doing more things.
I am right now publishing a new book in October called The Chef and the Slow Cooker, and then still operating. Yeah, good. And then we're doing still the restaurants. We're opening up more coffee shops, which are called Spiller Park Coffee, and doing a lot of consulting. So it's been great. And just traveling and doing a lot of food festivals and guest chefing events. So it's been good.
Hello. Look back in the past and tell me how far Southern cooking has come as an iconic culinary tradition.
Well, I think it's come a long way. I think it's primarily just gained respect. And I think it was once respected, but now it really is again. And I think that's a really important step.
But everybody's made it healthier.
Yeah, and healthier is definitely better. We found a way to lighten up food, because I don't think we're done defining Southern food. We're constantly changing it and evoking more creativity in it, but the backbone is still there.
You've got a great chef's club in the South.
We do have a great chef's club, yeah.
Thank you. I know you're busy. People are lining up behind me. Thanks for talking.
Nobody's behind you, but that's good.
Tell that.
I know. No, it's okay. I'm very honest.
Next up, Jimmy Banas from Chicago, who emphasized that he's just the leader of the band. His whole family's in the restaurant business.
Jimmy Banas, are you the head of this fraternity?
I'm the head of the clan, actually, right here. Head of the Banas clan. Third generation restaurateurs in Chicago. My son is the fourth, and my partner at the Purple Pig. I have Heaven on Seven restaurants, and it's a family affair. It's a beautiful thing.
And in Chicago, but scattered across Chicago, where are people going to look?
All in Chicago. I have a couple other places in the suburbs, but basically we're concentrated in Chicago. Two blocks away. My son's on the Mag Mile. I jump on the Mag Mile, and then we're on right across the street from Macy's or Marshall Fields, if you've ever been to Chicago.
Yeah, there's a Hilton Hotel right there.
Oh, no, that's
a little bit further down. Okay. No, there's one, the Park Hilton, that I used to stay at sometimes. That was right opposite Marshall Fields.
Right, you're exactly right. That was in the I can't think of the goofy name of the I can't think of the name of that mall there. I cannot believe it. But you're right. There was a Marshall Fields right on the ground floor.
Give us the story behind this, because all I hear about is the finish line. Tell me about background.
No, I'm not. I'm just starting. I'm not at the finish line. No, our start was started from my dad's mother in the mid 1900s. She took over her brother's restaurant that got two brothers got deported back to Greece, and then they so she started working. My grandfather was sold vegetables on the horse and wagon, and then he started working with my grandmother, and then my dad as a little kid started working, and that's how it all started. And then on my mom's side, her father was in Prohibition. He was actually in a town called Cicero, which was famous for Al Capone and things like that. So, but it's good. So then the kids took it. We took it over. I mean, we moved it up. We bought another restaurant. It was me and my dad in the kitchen. my mom and my brother in the front of the house, and that 37 years later, we have one of the best Louisiana-style restaurants in the country. So it's good. But I got to go because I got to feed some people.
Andrew Curran from Austin, Texas, is a veteran of that city's fine food culture and makes the most wonderful charcuterie.
So, Andrew Curran, why is Austin such a hot town for food?
You know, there's a lot of young chefs out there doing some really cool food. It's a beautiful town. People are friendly, and the food is great. When you get a bunch of young kids doing some really fun things and feeding off of each other in a friendly, not a competitive environment, the food just gets better and better, and the customers really get to take advantage of it.
Now, you're not one of those young guys. So where do you fit into this litany of great chefs in Austin?
My first restaurant in Austin I opened 10 years ago. Easy Tiger was my second restaurant, and I've since opened 3 more. So I have 5 restaurants in Austin. So, yeah, I'm kind of one of the older ones, I guess, but still feeding off the energy of all the great chefs in the town.
Now, I can see some of the specialization right in front of me because we have all kinds of charcuterie and sausage and that kind of, is that a big part of what you do, or is there much more than that?
Absolutely. Easy Tiger is very based on smoked meats, bread, mustards, cured meats, pickles. We have a bakery upstairs and a beer garden downstairs, and the food is salty cured meat that goes really well with beer.
Sounds like a winner. I was thinking of going to get a beer, but Ann keeps on making me work here.
I just want to say that, I mean, I've eaten my share of smoked meat. This is really spectacular stuff.
Thank you very
much. You know, and labor intensive. I mean, you do all this in-house.
Absolutely. We make everything from the bread, the mustard, the pickles, every piece of meat that you taste. We do beef jerky. We make our own Chex Mix. Everything's just a labor of love. We make sauerkraut in 100-gallon rain barrels. You know, our corned beef and pastrami takes 20 days just to corn, and then we cook it. So everything takes a little bit of magic to make it happen, for sure.
You're dedicated, and I'm telling you, this stuff is absolutely delicious. Franklin Barbecue gets all the press, but I really do think that Easy Tiger should be up there.
Oh, I appreciate that. I'll let Aaron know.
That's not fair. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you all.
Cassidy Dabney is the chef at a wonderful establishment in Eastern Tennessee. I believe the official town is Wallen, Tennessee. And, sweetheart, what's the name of the property? Blackberry
Farms.
You know, one of the great regrets in my life is I've never been to Blackberry Farm, and I kept, well, your late owner, I mean, I kept suggesting maybe he should invite us there, and he never did. Now it's too late. So I'm envious of you working there. Tell us what you do.
I'm the executive chef of the barn at Blackberry Farm, and I have a whole lot of fun going to the garden, picking things, and then making sure they make it on the menu.
Where were you before? Let's say you're Cassidy, right? Cassidy?
Yeah, Cassidy Dabney. Before I was at Blackberry Farm, I was at the Capitol Hotel in Little Rock, Arkansas. And then before that, I spent 7 years traveling around at different Four Seasons across the country.
Well, I mean, what are you serving up tonight? We're talking in context of this big event with the Food and Wine, Music City Food and Wine. What are you doing tonight?
Tonight we wanted to do something that was kind of an end of summer. So we have crispy eggplant with a pepper jam, some pickled ramps, hazelnuts from our hazelnut orchard that we have behind our garden, and then a little bit of dill yogurt. We love using dill on the menu because it's a companion plant for a lot of the things we grow in our garden.
I grow it. I didn't know it was a companion plant, but yeah. Since your founder died, are there major changes in the farm?
No, there aren't any major changes. What I think happened after Sam passed is that we all kind of like got together and said, let's do this. Let's make it just as awesome as he always envisioned, and maybe even more so. So it's really been something that's pushed everybody, I think, a little bit farther.
Anything else you'd like to put out there about what you're doing, what's new with the farm or what?
No, we just keep doing what we do, and I'm very fortunate to have a really, really amazing staff, and we just keep bringing inspiration to one another every season.
It's huge. I mean, you have all these different production areas, all kinds of things. Yes. Besides your chefing, you make cheese,
we make beer, we make charcuterie, sausages, jams, jellies, preserves, pickles. We have a lot going on any given day. So if you ever get bored at work, then you're just not trying, because there's so many things to see and do and learn.
Well, if you ever want us to come and visit, let us know.
Thank you.
Our next guest, Marcus Samuelson, not only made a culinary mark, he also made a...
Oh, his...
what's the right word I'm thinking of for dress code?
Sartorial.
There we go.
Splendid. Sartorial splendor.
Sartorially splendid as well as always interesting.
Marcus Samuelson, you were just so iconic, but let me tell you something. I could not believe you were opening in London.
I love London. We're in East London, and it's been really fun. It's really fun.
Well, we love London, and yeah. We go there all the time, and there is something of everything. But you're bringing, how would you describe what new you're bringing?
Well, first of all, a real Southern, a Harlem experience to London. It's fun. We have gospel brunch, stuff like that that maybe was not a new definition of what American restaurants could be. To London, which has been so much fun, and people are loving it. We've been very fortunate. We're very busy and we're having a great time.
How many restaurants total do you have now?
I mean, I have my spots in Scandinavia and London and, I'm in New York, of course. So, it's about 9 places.
Oh, wow. 9. I don't know. Tell us where those places are.
London, Bermuda, Sweden, National Harbor, New York, Harlem.
They're also nice places to visit, aren't they?
They're amazing. My wife, my son, and I—we just came back from Bermuda. Amazing, and of course, when we're in London, it's a great city to be in. So it's also good for our little one to see the world, right? Look at that, pretty cool.
Now you're cooking an unusual thing tonight for a man whose restaurants are called Red Rooster. Yeah. It's called Doro Watt Lasagna, yeah. And perhaps that has something to do with your original heritage.
Definitely. It's really a play on the Italian influences on Ethiopian cooking. So, it's a nice lasagna that we made with an Ethiopian chicken, stew called Doro Watt. And it's delicious. Guys, can I have 2 portions, please? So we have that, Ethiopian Berber spice that is beautiful when we cook the red sauce. And then we do our own fresh cheese and, put that on top.
Great. Well, Londoners, I'm sure, as you said, are loving it. We'll have to catch up with you the next time we go there so we can sample it for ourselves.
Thank Marcus. You very much. Thank you for having me. And enjoy tonight.
And last but by no means least, probably our absolutely most favorite chef, Alon Shire from award-winning restaurants in New Orleans.
Yeah.
Alon Shire is standing right next to me, towering over me from a great height, with the biggest Negroni I've ever seen in his hand.
You gotta always do doubles at festivals like this, because it's too hard to get back to the bar. So it's always a double. That's why it looks so big.
Hey, I'm working real brief because we've lined out the yin yang here outside your booth. You're like my most beloved chef, and
Thank you.
I've always loved you. And I want to come to New Orleans to go to that Monday. You have a Monday night shabbat?
A Monday night red beans and rice.
Yeah,
that we do at our house every year. Or every Monday.
Okay, you've got Shia. You work with the Besh group. You do all the You have a cookbook coming out. Would you tell us when and what it's about? It's your story.
Yeah, the book's called Shia, My Journey Back to Israel, and it comes out March 13th, but it's available for pre-order now. So it's available on Amazon and on our website at a lot of local bookstores. And it's 26 short stories of my life and recipes that are blossomed through those short stories with really great illustrations and photography. I'm very excited about it.
Well, I think you're having a really good time. You have a good wife?
I do have a great wife, yes. Emily, she's the best. Makes a mean pot of red beans and keeps me on track.
And anything else in the future you're planning besides your book, recipe-wise?
That's really what we're working on the most now, is getting this book ready and, you know, making sure Shia Dominica and Pizza Dominica are running well every day like well-oiled machines.
You're not telling me anything new. Tell me something along Shia.
Let's see. You know, there really isn't much new other than the cookbook. That's been the biggest thing that we've been working on, so we're focusing on that.
Here's a question for you. What are you going to win next?
Oh, my gosh. I hope that I win a good night's sleep tonight. That's what I'm looking forward to the most.
But you had a big win at the James Beard Awards for one of your staff.
Yes.
That must have been really exciting.
Zach Engel is our chef at Shia, and he's a freak of nature. He's an amazing, smart, talented guy. He works his butt off, and he's really just an inspiration to me. He's one of my most, like, I always try to live up to him, you know. He does such amazing work, and he won the James Beard Award for Rising Star Chef of last year, and he's an amazing person and a great, great chef.
You may have to wait till the clock turns 10 years, and then you can be Restaurateur of the Year or something like that.
We'll see. I don't know. I'm happy with what we've been able to accomplish so far, for sure.
Well, I mean, there's more than we can say at this point, and we'll talk to you probably next at the Beards.
I hope so. I hope I'll be there.
And now maybe we'll be there in New Orleans.
Okay, I hope to see you there.
Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. Great to see you guys, always.
I know.
Thank you for your time tonight.
Oh, not at all.
You're wonderful. I hope you.
I sure hope we got everybody in, and it's time to take a break before we go through the last mile.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
So anyway, for our final guest in today's program, we're just taking a relatively short few hundred miles up the road to North Carolina and the town of Durham, North Carolina, where our guest, Jamie Dement, who calls herself the Farmhouse Chef, has a restaurant called Piedmont, which is not a surprising name since that's the Piedmont region of North Carolina. And interestingly enough, she also has a 55-acre farm, and the story is as much about the farm as
Jamie Dement, you are on a farm in North Carolina, that beautiful state, and you are a Southern cook, more or less, but there's something else in this book. You, first of all, you're practically a world traveler, and you've picked up influences from everywhere, and it shows in the sophistication of these recipes.
Yes, so we do live on a farm in right in the heart of North Carolina in Hillsboro, but we're lucky we are able to, you know, to travel a decent amount now, and my partner Richard and I both have spent our whole lives traveling, and we both love food. Obviously, we've dedicated our whole lives to it, and we love to cook. I've always loved to cook. I'm from a very, very strong family of women who show their love through feeding people and feeding each other, and so I grew up with this kind of love of producing food and cooking it and being around it. And as I've traveled, you know, throughout my life, you pick up things as you go. You learn, you know, in Greece, you learn to cook lamb really, really well, and you know, and you come back from the French countryside with new recipes. So it's actually a great way to travel because you really get to kind of dig into individual cultures a lot more, because you're, especially if you can eat in people's homes. Because, you know, when you're eating in someone's home, they're going to want to show you what they think is the best. You know, what is the best food that they think you can get in Greece? What's their grandmother's favorite recipe? So I've tried to make sure that those stories and those kinds of foods are kind of populated throughout the book. But I also think that that it's important to kind of point out that I am from the South and I do live in the South, and this, you know, it's not your typical Southern cookbook of just, you know, fried chicken and collard greens, but the face of the South is changing every day, and it's become a very economically and racially diverse area, and so you can't just assume that the food of the white South is the food of all the South. You have to look at it from a very, very ethnically diverse point of view.
Yeah, I'm glad that's becoming a well-recognized piece of history. And the Lee brothers liked your book, huh?
Yes, they did. They're wonderful. Matt and Ted were fantastic from the beginning. They were they offer this thing, they call it cookbook camp. And it's honestly the best thing, that if you have an idea for a cookbook in your head but you're not exactly sure how to work the process and what steps you need to take, they're the only reason that I was able to pull it all together and get a cookbook out in the world, because they've done it so many times, and they've done it so well.
We've interviewed them, I don't know how many times, and
they're wonderful at helping you. You know, like, I had this monster of a book. I mean, it was huge. It would have been 10 times the size of the book that I produced. and they helped me. You know, they said, okay, you know, go through it with fresh eyes, look at it from the point of view of the audience you want to sell it to. One, decide who your audience is, think about how they're going to use it, and, you know, they were wonderful. And they also, you know, getting a book out into the world is not the easiest thing. And they were wonderful at answering questions about, you know, how do I get an agent? What do I do? What does my proposal need to look like? You know, should I send them this whole book that I've made? And the answer to that was, no, never. Don't send that monster out.
Yes.
So they were instrumental in helping me figure out how to make it work. And they also just, you know, they believed in it from the beginning, and having someone who, you know, who believes in you is invaluable.
It's a really wonderful book. I mean, the recipes are
really
intriguing, and they're very, as you said, I mean, it's just, they're very expansive in terms of references to different cultures and cuisines.
Well, when you're cooking on a farm and you're cooking for people who have worked very hard all day long, you don't want to keep feeding them the same thing over and over again, especially when you're working, you know, there's always pork at the farm, and there's always chicken, and there's always beef. If you're feeding them the same thing over and over again, it doesn't feel fantastic, and it doesn't feel like a reward. So I try to make our family meals at the farm, I try to make them, you know, a little celebration on a random Wednesday night, just to say thank you for the work that they do and for the lives of, you know, I think variety is important.
Well, it's part of your personality that you feel that way. No, my grandmother was a cook. Her brother had a dairy farm in Guernsey County, Ohio.
Oh, wonderful.
And she hated cooking.
Oh, no.
I mean, she was really a city gal, and she really shouldn't have been on the farm. She liked socializing and card parties and things like that. So she would cook, you know, like 6 a.m. on and all the way through. And I remember she had so many creamed onions.
Oh, gosh.
Over and over and over again, creamed onions.
Oh, my goodness. I bet everyone smelled like an onion.
I guess. So she wasn't the right person for that job, because that's a big job cooking for all the people on a farm.
Yes. So it's a fun job, though. I like it.
Well, I mean, see, you do, but that's your personality.
Yes, it is. Well, I make everything a party, so.
That's good. Yeah. I mean, some of these recipes, I don't even know where they came from, like berry compote with ricotta and toasted peanuts.
Well, so those recipes, the ones that you look at and you're like, how is she making this a dessert? It's because I will get to the end of dinner and think, I've got to feed these people dessert. What is in the cabinet? And I open the refrigerator, and there's ricotta cheese, and I know I've got honey, and I always have toasted nuts. And so you throw it together, and it works.
Here you have tuna ceviche with pickled okra and Roma tomatoes. That's a little off the wall, too.
It is a little off the wall, but I have, you know, so I try not to have to, you know, buy many things off the farm. And, you know, when I'm looking at a recipe that has capers in it, I'm thinking, well, I don't have any capers, but I have a ton of pickled okra.
Right.
And so I tend to substitute pickled okra every time there's a caper in a recipe.
Uh-huh. Now, we didn't really begin at the beginning of the story here. Not sure I understand which came first, the farm or the restaurant or the family that cooked.
Right. Okay.
Put it all in sort of an order for me.
I'll put it all together. So I'm from Eastern North Carolina. My family owned the farm supply in the area that I was from, and so I grew up. I grew up in town, not on a farm, but in a definite farming community and around farmers. And it's what, you know, that farming community is what supported my family for generations. I mean, the business before it closed was the oldest business in our county.
Wow.
And so I grew up in this community, and unfortunately, 80s and 90s were not the greatest time for farming in North Carolina. There was a big tobacco buyout. The whole kind of farming economy changed. And I saw a lot of it peter out and die. I saw the family farm supply go under. I mean, it was not a happy time for that side of farming in North Carolina. And so my kind of gut reaction to that was, I got to get out of here. I got to leave North Carolina. This place is drying up and dying. And I did. I went to University of North Carolina, and then from there moved to Washington, D.C. and worked on Capitol Hill and really loved it. Had a great time. It's a fantastic thing to do as a, you know, a 20-something. It was a very active social whirlwind.
Yes.
And I really did make everything a party. But the whole time I was there, I just felt, you know, as much fun as I was having, North Carolina was calling me home. And eventually I moved back here. And when I moved back here, I met Richard. I was helping do fundraising at the Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. And he was a board member there. He had just bought Coon Rock Farm about 2 months before we met. And then he bought, he started Deli and Ritz Restaurant with our business partner, Sarig and Nancy Agassi. And it had been open a couple months also, when I met him. And so when I came in, I gradually, you know, became a part of the, running the restaurant, doing the marketing and outreach. And then, at first, the farm was very much a weekend pursuit for us. We went out. Richard had four kids, still has four kids. When I met him, they were between 8 and 14.
Wow.
And now they're 21 to 26. And so at the beginning, we were taking the kids out on the weekends just to kind of give them, you know, room to roam and play. And they made the decision to move to the farm full time. It was, you know, we would get to Sunday night and they'd say, Dad, we don't want to go back to town, because we were all living in Raleigh then.
Oh, that's nice. And
we would say, well, we don't want to go back either. And so we packed up and all six of us moved out to the farm. We left 6,000 square foot house in downtown Raleigh and moved into 1,100 square feet with one bathroom. Four children, two adults, one bathroom, and not a lot of indoor space. But it was a 55-acre beautiful farm, and the kids could run, and they could ride horses and four-wheelers, and they could swim in the river, and, you know, it's what you think is a perfect kind of pastoral growing up moment. Uh-huh. And from there, we started growing gradually. At first, we grew just produce for the restaurant, and then we added chickens and sheep, and then we added pork, and then we added beef, and for a while, we were growing every season. And, you know, now we've kind of right-sized things, and we grow for our CSA program, for Bella Bean Organics, which is our kind of online farmers market, and then we have a second restaurant in Raleigh. When our business partner, Sarig, retired, we sold Deli, the first restaurant in Raleigh, and now we have a second restaurant in Durham, which is Piedmont. And so we also grow produce and raise meat for
you're busy.
Well.
You're really busy, Jamie.
We're busy, but we work with great people. We couldn't do what we do without this kind of wonderful network of people that we work with.
Well, now your recipes are organized according to the season,
yes.
Starting with summer, which I guess is when you have the most to work with.
And it's when you're building your pantry. You know, it's hard to braise that pork shank in December or November if you haven't, you know, put up the roasted tomatoes in July that you're gonna use to braise the pork shank. So I think that you have to that's why I started with the summer, because it was really important to me that you, that you're grounded in and what are going to be some of your base ingredients for later recipes.
You know, that's sort of how I grew. In fact, I was, as reading this, I'm thinking, you know, we're kind of alter egos, kind of, not even alter egos, but separated at birth types. You know, I'm an only child, and I grew up in a family of strong female, you know, cooks.
Awesome.
And, yeah. And
it's a great way to grow up.
And all this canning and growing tomatoes. And, you know, I mean, it's like, so, yeah. I don't have that touch, though. You managed to carry on that gene.
I hope I have.
Yeah. So, but the thing that distinguishes this book, by the way, the photography is excellent, too.
Yes, that's all Felicia Perry Trujillo. She is phenomenal. Well, I did all of the farm shots, that's my photography. So that's a farm or the animal or the fields, I took all those, and Felicia did all the food photography. And she and I did all the styling for it. It was me and her.
Uh-huh.
Lots of busy days.
Yeah, I'm... But as I said, your recipes are just so interesting. I mean, on their own,
without any
of the issues that we're all involved with, such as sustainability and seasonality and all that stuff. Your recipes are interesting and fat on their own and delicious.
Thank you.
And you could see, and apparently, the cooking of Greece has affected you a lot, because you have a lot of references to Crete and Greece.
I lived in Greece for a summer in college, and I go back a lot. We have a very good friend of ours is Greek, and she still owns property there, so we're lucky enough that we have a place to stay, and it's in the countryside, so when we're there, we're living with Greek people, and we're eating with Greek people, and we're very much, you know, completely and totally immersed in Greek culture and Greek life. So it's a great, you know, it's a great lifestyle and a great way to eat. I mean,
I love it, but I never had a bad meal in Greece ever.
Oh, no.
And but I was also the heaviest I've ever been in my life.
Yeah, I feel like
I ate everything. I couldn't stand not eating.
You eat everything on the table, and they need to feed you.
They're
worse than Southerners at, like, do you want another helping, and can we give you some more?
I was raised like that too, because my background is Sicilian, which is Greek. Basically.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Basically. Yep.
So, but you take like boiled peanuts. Now, what did the Lee brothers think about that? Your boiled peanuts?
Oh, they loved it. They thought that was great.
Yeah.
They're not, they don't have a corner on the boiled peanut market yet.
But, I mean, it's all done. I mean, you throw in some crushed red pepper flakes.
Yes. Well, so it doesn't have to be just the boiled peanut recipe from the gas station in South Carolina. You can spice it up a little bit.
Uh-huh. Yeah, but, there's just, what was it I saw? I mean, I don't, what was it? It was kale salad. What was it?
There's
kale kimchi, and then there's... That's kale kimchi. I mean, I really think that this kale thing has been so overdone, but you write a recipe for kale kimchi, and I startle up. That one,
delicious.
Hit me.
You'll love it, I promise. And kale is very overdone. But honestly, we sell a lot of it, and I always have a ton of it, so I have to have something to do with it. When you look out and think, oh, my God, we can't eat sauteed kale again, I have to make it taste different.
Yeah. Now, I was very moved about your father's death, the timing of it. And this is such a nice picture of him cooking.
Yes, so that photo was taken just, probably 2 weeks before he passed away. It was a very sudden and unexpected thing. And it's been a hard process to have the book come out and to see those photos and know that he's not getting to enjoy it. But he did. He recipe tested every recipe in the book except for the ones with peanuts in them.
So he did the recipe testing.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, he didn't do the recipe testing. He sat in the kitchen.
He sat and ate them all.
Ate them all. Yes. He gave plenty of feedback.
But he didn't like the peanuts?
He was allergic to peanuts. He had anaphylaxis.
Oh, dear. That's terrible.
Yeah, so I had to be very careful with all the peanut stuff.
So... pick out some of your favorite recipes from this book.
Oh, gosh. Honestly, the field pea recipe is one of my favorites, because field peas and butter beans are some of my favorite foods to eat, and they're so simple and easy. The brown sugar pork ribs are very, very wonderful there. a family and farm favorite. Everybody loves them. They're a bit of a process because you have to parboil and then grill, but they're really delightful and fun for a crowd. The Beer Braised Pork Shank is wonderful for winter. It's really hearty and lovely. The cream tart in the strawberry cream tart in the spring section is phenomenal and easy and delicious and so pretty. It looks like, you know, a perfect piece of spring.
And you have spicy chicken heart skewers. I mean,
oh yes, they're wonderful. They're also a family favorite. We had those last weekend. They're usually the treat after we've done chicken fat testing. But they're so good. People get nervous about heart and liver and anything like
that. Street food in Peru.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I mean, people need to not be nervous about heart. It's a muscle. It's absolutely delicious. You just have to treat it right. You need to season it well. You need to not overcook it so that it doesn't get tough. And it really is wonderful. And it's one of those things, you know, the first time you're standing on the sidewalk in Peru and somebody's trying to give you a chicken heart, you think, oh, I don't eat heart. And then you have a bite of it, and it is, you're like, oh, my God, there are so many fantastic flavors here. I can't wait to have more. And then you come home and you cook it.
Well, you're fun to be around, Jamie. I mean, I think
Thank
that we
you.
Could have a lot of fun having a cooking session.
We should sometime.
I think an eating session would be even more fun.
Okay, but yeah, that might be much more fun.
Well, thank you so much for sharing so much of your life with everybody.
Well, thank you.
The Farmhouse Chef is the name of the book, and it comes highly recommended from Miss Anne.
Yes, it did.
Thank you so much.
Jamie DeMint, much success with your book. And
thank you.
And Mr. Haig, I want you to note her asparagus and potato frittata.
I bet mine's almost as good.
That's one of his specialties.
Oh, so, fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. So we had a lot of fun with your book, Jamie. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Y'all have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Well, we hope you've enjoyed today's fast-paced program.
Yeah. And you know what we forgot to mention?
What's that?
That it was like over 90 degrees Fahrenheit the whole time.
Fortunate there were lots of potable beverages on hand.
Exactly.
And a good time was had by all, you may be sure of that. This town of Nashville sure is hopping.
It certainly is. And the music city label on it. I mean, remember we went through a gospel brunch, a big concert that was just packed.
And a great deal of fun was had by all. So we're glad we went back to Nashville one more time, and we hope that you'll take advantage of the festival again next year, because it really is a good time to be had by all. And until next week, same time, same place, we'll say goodbye now.
Bye-bye.